All right. For the last talk of the day, Dr. Grant will be talking on hyperinsulinism and the surgeon. Dr. Grant.
Well, we'll go from last talk, which was something I think you find very commonly, to something that actually is rare, but I think fascinating. And in fact, this may be more applicable today, at least in some respects, than it might have been 10 or 15 years ago. Let's start just with a bit of history. As you'll recall, this is Paul Langerhans in 1869, who was the first to identify the islets which bear his name. I might just point out that he was a medical student when he did that. In 1923, the Nobel Prize was awarded to Banting and MacLeod. Now, those aren't the names that you remember, but MacLeod was a biochemist, and on a flip of a coin, Charles Best, a medical student, was awarded the opportunity to work in MacLeod's lab under the tutelage of Frederick Banting, and they discovered insulin. And subsequently, were awarded the Nobel Prize, and Banting, in true gentlemanly fashion, split his award with his medical student, Charles Best. I wouldn't have done that, but I guess he's, you know. So if we looked at insulinoma, 1924 is when that history starts, with spontaneous hypoglycemia in five patients. The first known insulinoma resection occurred in Rochester at Mayo Clinic, with William Mayo doing the operation. Unfortunately, the patient was a surgeon from South Dakota who had an unresectable insulinoma, and he died about 4 to 6 weeks postoperatively from the disease. The first successful surgical treatment of an insulinoma was by Roscoe Graham just 2 years later. Alan Whipple described 62 patients with islet cell tumors, half with hypoglycemia, and then 3 years later published his now famous triad. In 1950, the U.S. literature, in fact, it may have been the world's literature at that point, comprised 400 cases of insulinoma, 90% benign, 13% multiple, 9% operative mortality, which was significant. But the biggest thing about this series was that a third of these patients failed to have their tumor identified at the time of the operation, and 20% were never found. That led to progressively more effort at trying to find these, and angiography became the mainstay, but not a very successful one. The University of Michigan, a leading endocrine center at that time, only had about a 40% identification rate, and we thought we had it pretty well in the bag, reporting an 87% positive angio rate. But if you look carefully at that study, only half were identified preoperatively. So if you go back and retrospectively see it afterwards, that's great for the radiologist, not so great for the surgeon. And then in the 70s, the state of the art was sort of consolidated again by a review of the world's literature, over 1,000 cases, but still a quarter of the patients had unsuccessful surgery because the tumor just could not be found. And it was out of this article that the recommendation was forwarded that if you could not find the tumor at that time, you progressed with a left-to-right sequential partial pancreatic resection until, in fact, if you went to the ultimate nth of that, you would have about a 90% resection. And if you still hadn't removed it, you ought to be able to see it in the remnant. That was at least talked about, but I don't know how commonly it was actually practiced. If we classify hypoglycemia in adults, that is true pathology. The first, of course, is insulinoma. The second is factitial, and we've all had interesting stories, whether we've experienced them ourselves or others have talked about, where patients are given or have taken insulin surreptitiously, and that was a leading cause some years ago. In fact, we had a patient who's who was a guy that came to Rochester, and he ultimately was found to be injected by his wife as a means of trying to kill him. And he ended up with an operation. She ended up in the slammer. So today, however, sulfonylurea is probably the biggest source of factitial hypoglycemia, and it's just a mistake. And just to give you an idea, these two are oral hypoglycemics. These two are very commonly used antihypertensives. It's not hard to understand why these could be mistakenly taken. If you thought you were taking an antihypertensive and took an oral hypoglycemic and developed hypoglycemia. There is a rare syndrome in the United States of autoimmune hyperinsulinemia. It's associated with very high anti-insulin antibodies, but very rare. You have to think of that. And the key to that is when you measure insulin, they are extraordinarily high levels of insulin in the hundreds, if not thousands. And insulinoma just doesn't do that. And then this thing called non-insulinoma pancreatogenous hypoglycemia syndrome. I don't mean to make that a mouthful of gibberish. I'll get to that later, but that may have some real implication even today. There are multiple subtypes, sporadic single disease, single tumor, that's the most common. Less than 5% have sporadic disease and yet have multiple tumors. The MEN pancreas is really quite complicated. It's virtually always multiple in the MEN patient. But the question is, are they all hyperfunctioning or just one hyperfunctioning with a lot of non-functioning pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors? And then, of course, the potential for the insulinoma to be malignant. As I said, I'll get to this unusual syndrome at the end. It's the most common islet cell tumor, and yet only 4 cases per million person years. What that means is if you look back over the years, virtually no institution amasses more than 10 cases in any year. And I think that has significant implications relative to a learning curve of how to remove them safely and even how to remove them safely laparoscopically, which is the coming trend. Whipple's triad, symptoms of hypoglycemia coupled with a glucose measured at less than 50 and relief of the symptoms with glucose administration. A very reasonable triad even today. But if you translate this into let me go to this first, and that is the symptoms can be largely of two types. CNS dysfunction, so-called neuroglycopenia. I'll show you those symptoms in just a moment. Typically when the glucose drops below 50. I think many, if not most, maybe all in this room have felt at times when you think you're a little hypoglycemic after missing breakfast and operating for hours, you get sweaty, tachycardic, the glucose is below 50. Fortunately, you don't have an organic thing and your epinephrine will most of the time rescue you, or you'll faint and then you'll be rescued. With an insulinoma, one of the characteristic symptoms is visual disturbances, double vision, blurry vision. I asked a patient once, they said, I get double vision. And I said, when does that happen? He said, well, several times when I was driving. And I said, well, which side do you go to? And he said, I just try to go down the middle. Not a good thing. And if they have it and you know it, they don't get to drive until it's fixed. They get palpitations, sweating, confusion, and abnormal behavior. And in fact, many will not remember those, and that's why most patients with an insulinoma come with a friend or a spouse who's actually observed the behavior, which often is syndromic for each person. And it'll be even odd, weird, even sometimes humorous behavior, but it usually is confusion and very abnormal. And they can also have symptoms of amnesia, coma, and seizures. Here, I think, is one of the most important parts of this talk, and that is, how do you make the diagnosis? Again, it's nice to have a very competent endocrinologist. But the key to this, in my opinion, is the glucose being less than 50, and ideally, I like to see it less than 45. When I say the insulin needs to be over 3, that just depends on the lab. The key part about that is you have to be able to show, the lab has to be able to measure confidently some insulin in the blood, because the beta cells shut down completely when the glucose is under 50. So if you see a glucose of 45 and measurable insulin, they've got abnormal insulin. You want to get a C-peptide to make sure it's endogenous insulin and that they aren't giving themselves insulin. And the last thing is sulfonylurea screen. You want that to be negative. So those four pieces need to be fulfilled in today's diagnosis. Now, we used to call it a 72-hour fast. That was nice vernacular, but in fact, we call it a supervised fast now because seldom does it really need to go 72 hours. Almost always within a full day, they have become hypoglycemic. The laboratory studies have been drawn, and the diagnosis is definitively made. So this is sometimes in an outpatient setting, it can be done, but you have to have good laboratory, good help. They have to know just how to do it. More often, it's usually done in a supervised situation, either in a clinical studies unit or in the hospital. Now, localization, you just heard about ultrasound. And what I would say is there are lots of imaging techniques. The ideal method, all of these things, doesn't exist. However, we do have a number of imaging techniques that can be valuable. We have had success with transabdominal ultrasound, but only about 60% of the time. This is an example of an insulinoma in the head of the pancreas, just anterior to the inferior vena cava. Many other institutions, including the NIH around the country, don't have success with this. We just happen to have very interested, intellectually committed ultrasounds to this particular disease, which is unusual. This is a CT scan, a mainstay of most everybody's armamentarium. You can see here's the tumor in the head of the pancreas. Here's another CT, again, this one in the tail of the pancreas, triple phase. Oftentimes, the islet cell tumor will show up on the arterial phase, so a big bolus is given during triple phase CT. And this one is a CT that I show that now reconstructing images is nothing unusual. This was the first time it had been used on an insulinoma. And as you can see, here's the splenic artery, here is the obvious tumor. But when we did the original CT scan, the splenic artery was overlying and obscuring view of the tumor. This is actually the second tumor this patient had. We had taken out the first one, you'll see when, 3 days before. She got better seemingly, but then within a day or a day and a half, she became hypoglycemic again, and we took her back and took that out. This is an example of the same kind of scan in the uncinate process of the pancreas with the superior mesenteric vein going to the portal vein right there. Endoscopic ultrasound is probably our single best localization test. It's not the first test we get, and the reason for it is that, first, it's a bit invasive. We have good success with cross-sectional imaging most of the time, but if we need to, this is the next test after ultrasound and CT. It's also, in my opinion, difficult for a surgeon to interpret all of the surrounding structures when you get this scan result. It's helpful when they tell you where it is, but I like to be able to see it in relationship to the other structures which you get on a CT scan. Angiography, as I said, was our gold standard for a long time, but not greatly successful. This is what a subtraction angiographic scan shows when a tumor is identified. This happened to be caught during what's called a calcium stimulation test. And that, in fact, is the test we get if the EUS is negative. And that's this. Catheters are placed in the inferior vena cava and lodged in the hepatic vein for blood sampling. And then a second catheter is threaded up the aorta and sequentially threaded into the gastroduodenal, superior mesenteric, and splenic arteries. And calcium is injected each time, and blood is drawn from the hepatic vein at 30, 60, and 90 seconds. What the artist here has demonstrated is there's a little tumor in the head of the pancreas, and what you'll see when you look at the results is that with the calcium stimulation in the gastroduodenal artery, the insulin level will go up at least two times the baseline, and most of the time dramatically more than that. Here, the SMA and splenic levels are basically flat and below two times. So that is a good regionalizing test. It really doesn't localize it, but it tells you it's somewhere in the head of the pancreas, which then can facilitate subsequently intraoperative ultrasound. This is probably our very best localization test. The problem is it's done under reasonably high pressure. If you don't know where the tumor is and you go to the operating room, you either find it or you're in hot water. This one shows the pancreatic duct 3 millimeters away from the tumor. This is one of the major benefits of intraoperative ultrasound, aside from localization, is demonstrating the surrounding anatomy. Pancreatic duct, common duct, principally. If it's 3 millimeters away, almost for sure that will be easily enucleatable, so to speak. Because when we do that, we stay right on the tumor. I'll show you that in just a little bit. Here, on the other hand, is a tumor where the pancreatic duct is sitting right on that insulinoma. Still possible to take this out, but valuable to know that you need to come this direction, not this direction, to get at it. Again, same thing, tumor, pancreatic duct, portal vein. Now, one thing that we like to do, makes you feel good, it's kind of exciting for the anesthesiologist who needs some excitement, is that you admit these patients the night before, put in an IV, and run D10 overnight so they don't become hypoglycemic because they're not going to get to eat anything. You stop that in the operating room, and with that, gradually their glucose level will predictably drop. It may drop to 70, to 60. And if their preoperative glucose levels have been in the 40s, they know about that, and you're not hurting them by waiting until it goes between 40 and 50. We don't let it get below that, and we monitor it about every 15 minutes. If we see it go below that, we take a little D50 and just give them a little bump of D50 to bring the glucose up some, but not to 250. When you take out the tumor, within 10 to 15 minutes, the glucose starts rising, and it will go up 10 to 15 milligrams per cent about every 10 or 15 minutes, and you can feel good that you've solved the problem. If it doesn't, you've got another tumor, probably. Has it been delayed as much as 40 to 50 minutes before it goes up? The answer is yes. So I wouldn't start doing other resections blindly on the basis of this. Now, for open management, we have used a generous incision, whether it's bilateral, subcostal, or midline, assessed for metastases, which are rare, less than 10%, expose and mobilize the pancreas, we used to say head to tail. But with the localization we have now, I think you can focus your mobilization many times. Most of the time we use intraoperative ultrasound, it helps reinforce, unless it's obvious where the tumor is, but it also is very helpful in defining the surrounding anatomy, the pancreatic duct particularly. We prefer to enucleate, but resect if it's in the distal, if it's in the tail or body, and anatomically difficult to remove safely, or if it's malignant. We no longer advise the sequential distal blind resection sequence. Here's a tumor by Netter in the uncinate process of the pancreas. Here it is a back away, and here's a close-up view. This pure mesenteric vein here with a couple tributaries that have been severed. And in this case, it's nice because the tumor is sitting on the surface, but very commonly it is not. It's buried in the pancreas. Here's another one. I said I wanted to show you an enucleation sort of in sequence. This, again, is sitting in the body of the pancreas right on the surface. Here's the tumor as we're lifting it out of the body. And here's the enucleation site, and you'll notice right there is the pancreatic duct. That wasn't a surprise because we saw this by the ultrasound. It was immediately behind that. It will come away from the pancreatic duct cleanly. If it doesn't, it's almost by definition a cancer. And many times it will dilate the distal duct if it's cancer. If it's dilated, it's malignant, because benign ones will cause it to deviate but not constrict. So if we look at the experience from 1982, and that is not quite when I started, but that's when we started doing intraoperative ultrasound, and look at that for 30 years through December of 2012. 420 patients with hypoglycemia. This group I'll talk about shortly, 332 patients with insulinoma. Sporadic in 400, a small number of MEN patients, reoperations in 33. If we look at first-time operations only and exclude MEN and exclude malignancies, we have 291 patients, slight female predominance. First thing is, these are generally small tumors. Almost 60% of these are a centimeter and a half or smaller. The localization sensitivity, intraoperative ultrasound is excellent. Calcium stimulation, that is regionalization, as I said, but it's very good. Angiography is probably a little bit less than that. A CT has gotten a little bit better. EUS is quite good. Standard transabdominal ultrasound, as I said, is about 60% in our hands. Positive predictive value is much higher. If you see something, almost always it's reliable, but not every time. You can have the occasional false positive. The insulinomas are generally pretty evenly distributed through the pancreas. I know that it's said that the beta cells tend to be more localized in the body and tail. It may be that we have an unusual referral of head tumors, because those are oftentimes more difficult to see by imaging. But in our experience, they're relatively evenly distributed. These are the surgical procedures we've done. Predominantly enucleation, quite a few distal resections, and the uncommon Whipple. This, to that point, to 3 years ago, we had done 12 laparoscopic procedures for insulinoma, 4 enucleations, 7 distal resections, and 1 Whipple, but with 4 conversions. So there is a learning curve to this. We cured 99% of these patients, again, excluding the NIF patients that I'll talk about in a second, the reoperative patients, or the MEN patient. Those are all unusual categories. The people that were not cured, that one lady I told you about that had 2 tumors, and we cured her with the second operation on post-op day 3. A patient who did not have MEN but had multiple tumors, we did not cure her. One patient, the tumor was not found, and the wrong diagnosis was the autoimmune hyperinsulinism, where no tumor was found, and we should probably not have operated on that patient. Complications, inevitably some pancreatic abscess, fistula collection 17%. Other complications are not common but not rare. These are big operations, atelectasis, urinary tract infection, et cetera. Laparoscopically, however, 50% had pancreatic complications. I think it's laparoscopically, at least in our hands, has been difficult to avoid either a collection or a small fistula. Most of those just seal off with nothing more than placement of a catheter non-surgically. The survival, not surprisingly for benign disease, is just as expected. Here is an example of an insulinoma in the head of the pancreas that was malignant, caused a dilatation of the distal duct. We resected that. This is clearly a malignancy. People who say that islet cell tumors do well, they do better than exocrine pancreatic cancers, but they still are quite malignant tumors. Now, the MEN1 insulinoma is complex and difficult. MEN syndrome, patients have insulinomas at times, and we for many years have thought those are multiple in over-secreting. There's no question they can be, because I've operated on two brothers who had insulinomas. We took out the distal pancreas, they became fine, and then they both relapsed with a second tumor. But what they also all have are other pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, which very commonly are non-functioning. However, insulinomas, even in the MEN syndrome, are commonly benign, but their associated pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors are the largest source of mortality for this group of patients. The problem is, They are hard to know just how to predict. Patients can live not just years, but decades with these tumors and be fine. If they have Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, they're not, that's a group that is unusually helped and never cured with a surgical approach. Insulinoma, we can cure those patients at least for a very prolonged time. The difference is hard to explain. So you can say, well, are there medical treatments for insulinoma and MEN? There are, but they're not great. Should we consider total pancreatectomy? I mean, if we take out the whole pancreas, and in fact, if we do a Whipple and take out the duodenum, you know, if they have Zollinger-Ellison syndrome in the MEN syndrome, it's usually duodenal wall tumors. And if we take out the whole pancreas, we take away all of their tumors, presumably before they metastasize. But the age is young, and you have the immediate consequence of both exocrine and endocrine insufficiency, as well as just the size of the operation. So we've not been willing to do that. So in essence, whatever we do is sort of a palliative operation. We're always leaving some pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors behind. We don't want to leave insulinomas behind, but we know we're leaving non-functioning tumors behind and hope that they don't behave in a bad way. As I said, they can live a long time even with these tumors. So what we often will do is do a distal subtotal pancreatectomy and enucleate what we can of the tumors in the head without causing undue morbidity. You have to take into consideration body habitus. If you resect a lot of the pancreas and they're obese, which insulinoma patients are not infrequently obese because they're having to eat to keep their brain working, you can leave them with diabetes. And pancreatic surgery inevitably has some morbidity. So you have to tailor the operation, and it's a complex series of things you have to consider. Now, something I just want to mention, and we've used this a few times. It came up because we had a patient who had disease come back, and probably we had done an enucleation of about 90% of the tumor. And the little leftover remnant regrew. And it was in a patient who, I mean, it was 12 years or 14 years between the first operation, and she had become elderly and not necessarily such a great operative risk. So we have done ultrasound guided either intraoperatively or with endoscopic ultrasound, injecting these tumors with alcohol. And it may take more than one session to do it, but we've had good success at ablating the hyperinsulinism. The tumor is still seen, that is, the shadow apparently is still seen, but it works well. Have we had some complications? Well, we had a pseudocyst that was about 10 centimeters that we waited out and it went away. So yeah, you can say we were lucky or benign neglect, but we haven't had to reoperate, and that was the worst complication, was a non-operatively managed pseudocyst. So this is an interesting fail-safe method that we kind of keep in our back pocket if it looks like a very high-risk situation from a surgical perspective. Okay, now to talk about that non-insulinoma pancreatogenous hypoglycemia. First, my colleague Jeff Thompson was the lead author on this article in 2000. What it is postprandial hyperinsulinemic hypoglycemia, which is different than fasting, which is the way insulinomas are. They have a negative 72-hour fast. You fast them, they do not become hypoglycemic. They do not drop their glucose below 50. They have negative localization studies. Why? Because it isn't a tumor. But they have positive selective arterial calcium stimulation tests. That is, when you inject them, they will typically have one or two areas of the pancreas that rise to two times the baseline. It's modest by comparison to insulinoma, but we think it is real. They do have relief of their symptoms in the hospital and for a while postoperatively by, as we call it, gradient-guided partial pancreatectomy. Almost, and you'll see the breakdown, almost all of these are distal pancreatectomies. You remove them, hand them to the pathologist, they cut all the way through it, and grossly, it looks completely normal. H&E stain, normal. Special stains show hypertrophic islets or nascidial blastosis. And I want to show you that. Then came the recognition that a lot of these patients, and that's why I say this is apropos perhaps for the surgeons here and in today's world, is it occurred after gastric bypass. This is an islet. You don't know that's hypertrophic unless I tell you that the pathologist measured and said it's bigger than 90% of the islets. This is nascidioblastosis defined as islet cells along the duct. So that's abnormal. Can you ever see that in the absence of this? Yes, in chronic pancreatitis and other situations. So is this pathognomonic? No. The theory is that glucagon-like peptide is over-secreted in these patients because they have rapid delivery of nutrients to the distal ileum because of their bypass. With that, they stimulate islet cell neogenesis and inhibit apoptosis. Do we see high GLP-1 levels in all of these people? No. This is a theory, but it hasn't been borne out as a true cause and effect. We operated on 85 of these patients, predominantly female. They had had, in 57 of these patients, gastric bypass, and in 12, they'd had other gastric or vagal operations. But in 16, they'd had no prior stomach or vagal surgery. Distal pancreatectomy in almost all, both of these were patients who were operated with a distal pancreatic resection and had to have a Whipple because they were still markedly symptomatic. That's a different story. And the last patient that we had before we sort of closed this series had a gastric bypass reversal. Now comes the outcome news, which we reported a few years ago. The median follow-up, 52 months, 4.5 years. And for the first 3 to 4 to 6 months to 8 months, these patients were happy. They were, most of them, doing well. Their crippling symptoms of hypoglycemia were resolved. But what we found was that at about 16 months, they relapsed. And not quite, but most patients, almost 90%, had recurrence of some of their symptoms. And when we tried to quantitate that, and some in the room may be old enough to recall the Visick classification for peptic ulcer, this is sort of along that line. That is, patients did well, patients did okay, not too well, and failure. And it's about 25% in each of those categories. So over half of our patients did poorly when they were followed up. It's on the heels of this that we decided we're no longer going to do the pancreatic resection for this problem. Honestly, I don't know what these patients, because I can't believe all of a sudden the spigot dried up, but we are not operating on these patients anymore. And when you try to reverse the gastric bypass, that is certainly not reliable as a solution. There have been patients who've had a reversal and still been symptomatic. So back to insulinoma as the main topic. If you have biochemical parameters that are positive with hypoglycemia, we get an ultrasound, then a CT, then an EUS. And in about 85% of the patients, if not more, we'll find the tumor by our imaging, take them to the operating room, and proceed surgically as appropriate. If they're negative, then you have an option. Do you take them to the operating room and use intraoperative ultrasound, since it is very good? For a while, we did that. It's cost-effective, but it's anxiety-provoking, some for the patient, more for me. I didn't like that because all the pressure occurred in the operating room. I'll show you a case in just a moment that was interesting in that regard. So now we get selective arterial calcium stimulation and at least regionalize the tumor. Now, sometimes we repeat a CT scan and it'll show it when the first one didn't. So, I mean, there are some variations to this, but that's the general sequence, and then go to the operating room. Now, this is the case I was talking about, and if there's one thing that I learned when I was working in Rochester is the value of teamwork. And I want to relate a patient just briefly. This is a young man who clearly was symptomatically hypoglycemic, came from New York and flew into this little island of humanity in the middle of large cornfields called Rochester, Minnesota, and he was convinced that we knew what we were doing. And he had his biochemical testing, and no question it was right. I was away at a meeting, kind of like this. I don't get these phone calls now, but I got a call from the best ultrasonographer we had at the Mayo Clinic looking at this, and he said, we found the tumor. It's just below the neck of the pancreas, right in front of the portal vein. And his characteristic comment was, this will be duck soup. Be careful when somebody says duck soup. So I came back, kind of easing into the operative day. That was the only case I had for that day. We open up, and of course, this would be a lousy story if I said, yeah, there it was, and we took it out. There was a lymph node. And yeah, we took it out, and it was a lymph node. And then we mobilized the pancreas and looked and could not find it. There are two hospitals in Rochester. I was at one. The guy who did it pre-op was at the other. So we asked the radiologists that are in our hospital to come down and have a look. They looked and couldn't find anything. So I called the other radiologist, and I said, you know, you thought that was right in front of the portal vein. He said, yeah. I said, well, that was a lymph node. And he said, are you still in the operating room? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'll be right over. That was pretty cool because it's only a mile away, but it put a hole in his work day, and yet he jumped on the the van and came downtown and scrubbed in. And he usually can find an insulinoma in about 10 minutes, if that, when he's scanning the pancreas, especially if we've got everything mobilized as we did. About 40 minutes into things, this is what he saw. Now, for good ultrasonographers, maybe this is duck soup, but he said, "Do you see where the coarse sand meets the fine sand?" I said, "Bill, what have you been smoking?" And he said, "No, I think you can even see a little sort of pseudocapsule around this." He said, "That's right against the duodenum." He said, "I don't think I've ever seen the ampulla. That's about the only thing that I can think of other than this being a tumor." And I said, "Okay." He said, "I can put a needle into that." I thought, my problem is solved. So he put a needle in. He pulls it out, and here's a jet of blood coming out the head of the pancreas. So my situation is I have somebody I've been operating on for 3 hours for a known insulinoma. I don't know where it is, and now I've got a bleeding head of the pancreas. There are days when you're not excited about being a surgeon. This was one of them at that point. And I held it, and fortunately it stopped. It usually does. And then he said, I want to do a few fine needle aspirations for cytology. I thought, knock yourself out. So he did, and about 15 minutes later, the pathologist calls us back and says, "That needle biopsy showed benign, normal pancreatic tissue." About then, I'm thinking, how do I break this news to the guy's wife? And he said, "You know, it could have been just because I had to go through normal pancreas to get to that." And about 10 minutes after that, the pathologist called back and said, "The fine needle aspiration is an islet cell tumor." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, come down and look at it yourself." Well, of course, I'm going to be the confirmatory guy at cytology of the pancreas, especially islet cell, since I'm such an expert. But I thought, what the heck, I might as well go down there. And he said, "Do you see all of those? They're all blue cells." Now, this was a fine needle aspiration that they set up and did right there in the frozen section lab, which in Rochester, fortunately for us, is about 40 steps from the operating room. He said, "That you normally don't see that at all. If you see, you might see one or two, but you certainly don't see a whole slew of these islet cells." He happened to be the best cytologist at Mayo. And I said, "Okay." He said, "That's right in the head of the pancreas." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "You're going to have to do a Whipple to get this out." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay." Well, he wasn't excited, but I was. And I went back and I thought, okay. So we took it out. And I took it to the path lab, and I picked up the big knife that, you transect specimens. And I said, "Come on over here, John." Well, here I am holding this knife, and I'm not sure what went through his mind, but I said, "I'm going to cut the specimen." And I did transect it right down, and what you see there are the two halves of the insulinoma. So this story ends up really pretty cool because I had incredibly great teamwork from two other guys, and that's pretty neat. Well, in conclusion, the diagnosis of insulinoma first rests on even thinking of the fact that somebody might have hypoglycemia, acting weird, and mental neuroglycopenia. You need to make sure that biochemically you're convinced. The imaging, we start with ultrasound, move to CT, EUS, and selective arterial calcium stimulation if necessary. The operation, if it's in the head, we try very hard to enucleate. Rarely a Whipple, most of the time enucleation if it's benign. Body tail enucleation, but distal pancreatectomy if it's in a poor location for enucleation. The laparoscopic approach is taking over. I think there will always be a place, or at least if I were doing it, there'd always be a place for an open exploration. But there are other people who are getting extraordinary with laparoscopic skills. I think the remaining challenge is laparoscopic enucleation. We need to figure out how to do that safely, securely, and diminish the pancreatic leak, but we've been trying to do this with open resection for a long time as well. For malignancy, as with everything else, we need continued drug innovation. And for NIFs, we have given up on the surgical approach to it, and honestly, I don't know what the right approach is. Thank you very much.